Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson, here with Steve Rendell. This week on Counterspin, there's been a lot of coverage of the murder of Dr. George Tiller, allegedly killed by an anti-abortion activist. But there's been relatively little discussion of the culture that such violence arises from, where mainstream anti-abortion figures regularly demonize abortion providers. And we're not just talking about Bill O'Reilly. We'll talk to Fred Clarkson, who's been monitoring and writing about anti-abortion violence for years. Also on the show, as the vetting process of prospective Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor goes forward, Americans can be forgiven for not actually knowing very much specific about the candidate's record. That's because big media have so far seemed more concerned that you know what Rush Limbaugh thinks of her. We'll discuss what's missing from that coverage with Adam Serwer of the American Prospect blog, Tapped. That's coming up, but first, as usual, we'll take a look back at the week's press.
A front-page story in the May 28th New York Times demonstrated how not to report on reproductive rights groups' reaction to the nomination of Sonia Sotomayor for the Supreme Court. Reporter Charlie Savage's lead explains that abortion rights advocates are worried about Sotomayor because, quote, when she has written opinions that touched tangentially on abortion disputes, she has reached outcomes in some cases that were favorable to abortion opponents, close quote. Those cases, she ruled in favor of the Bush administration's reinstatement of the global gag rule. She ruled that anti-abortion protesters could take police to court for allegedly using excessive force to break up one of their demonstrations. And she's ruled in a few cases in favor of Chinese refugees seeking asylum because of China's forced abortion policies. But who's uneasy about these? The only one cited by any major reproductive rights groups is the one on the global gag rule. And the second case would seem to be about abusive police conduct rather than reproductive rights. And the third category is absurd. A ruling against forced abortion is a pro-reproductive rights ruling. Pro-choice groups aren't protesting those, and it would be bizarre and troubling if they were. Savage even quotes an anti-choice activist saying as much, though in a much more pejorative way. Quote, even the most radical feminist would object to forcing women to abort wanted pregnancies, close quote. It's unclear how Savage came up with this list of supposed concerns. As far as one can tell from reading the article, the only people he spoke to were two anti-choice advocates. That's a mighty odd way to report on the feelings of reproductive rights supporters.
Imagine that the director of, say, Reverend Al Sharpton's National Action Network punched a woman in the head while uttering a racial slur. Now imagine further that 2 years after this hate crime took place, the executive director still had his job, and when Sharpton was asked about it, he remarked that he didn't know why the story was even newsworthy, and he insisted that he didn't have any day-to-day control over his organization. Well, is there any doubt that if such an incident happened, it would be a major national news story and Sharpton would be facing a firestorm of criticism? Yet, precisely such an incident did happen, except that the leader of the national movement was former Republican presidential candidate Tom Tancredo, and the perpetrator of the assault was Marcus Epstein, the executive director of Tancredo's anti-immigration group, Team America. Marcus Epstein pled guilty in 2007 to attacking an African-American woman by karate chopping her while saying the word nigger. Now, Tancredo, as noted, doesn't think it's newsworthy, but listeners might want to keep that story in mind when they hear Tom Tancredo accuse Supreme Court nominee Sonia Sotomayor, or anyone else for that matter, of racism.
MSNBC's Morning Joe program seems to have turned its conspicuous consumption of Starbucks drinks into a paid commercial for the coffee chain, according to the June 1st New York Times. As Brian Stetler put it, Joe Scarborough, quote, sips Frappuccinos on camera so often that some viewers have wondered whether it's a form of product placement paid for by the coffee company. Starting Monday, it will be, close quote. The deal is worth over $10 million and will include, quote, Starbucks graphics and mentions during each hour of the 6 to 9 a.m. program, close quote. The show might even broadcast from Starbucks locations from time to time. Indeed, on the first day of the deal, there was Morning Joe hosts Joe Scarborough and Mika Brzezinski slurping down Starbucks drinks while interviewing Starbucks CEO Howard Schultz. "It's been organic," said Scarborough. Quote, "People have asked us for years, Howard, how much does Starbucks pay you to drink your coffee? The product placement is wonderful," close quote. The hosts spent a good deal of time talking about which Starbucks drinks were best, while Starbucks Schultz remarked happily about how his company and the show could do things together. Conflict of interest? MSNBC President Phil Griffin says no way. Griffin said Morning Joe would continue to cover Starbucks as a news item if warranted. Said Griffin's, "They understand that we have standards."
You might give the Washington Post's Anthony Shadid credit for good intentions. His June 3rd article on Obama's Middle East outreach effort recognizes that there are some aspects of Mideast history that his readers ought to know about but probably don't. But it seems like any attempt to tell the truth about the Middle East has to be accompanied by a bodyguard of obfuscation, as with this passage. Quote, "The blacks and whites of U.S. policy always seem to give way to a far greater ambiguity in the region. Lies by a generation of authoritarian Arab leaders to their people have given many a healthy skepticism of any public statement, whatever the source." Close quote. You think skepticism of U.S. statements might maybe have more to do with what U.S. leaders have said and done rather than those lying Arabs? Just a possibility. And that's followed by this. Quote, "Footnotes of U.S. history have become seminal events in the Muslim world. A half century on, few people are unaware of the U.S. role in 1953 in helping overthrow Mohammad Mossadegh, the nationalist prime minister in Iran." Close quote. That first statement would be more accurate if it were reversed. Seminal events in the Muslim world have become footnotes in U.S. history. Unless Shadid really thinks that having a foreign power overthrow your elected government and install a dictator could be anything other than a seminal event.
And finally, here's a trope we were hoping was retired. The May 30th New York Times reported on the depressing phenomenon of Iraqi men who, when rejected by a woman they hope to marry, or her father, plant bombs in front of the woman's home. You might describe these men, many former insurgents, as disturbed or violent, but the Times had a different take. Their headline on the piece, "Lovelorn Iraqi Men Call on Wartime Skill." And here you thought it was a serious thing to endanger someone's life with an explosive. Turns out it's about love.
Thank you, Steve. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR.
The murder of Dr. George Tiller is one of many in a long line of violent attacks on women's health providers, and not even the first attack on Tiller himself, who was wounded outside his Wichita clinic by gunfire in 1993. While the story has been widely covered, the context of the violence, where religious leaders, national pundits, and abortion opponents refer to abortion providers as murderers and baby killers, has received less attention. Fred Clarkson is an expert on the religious right and the movement that for decades has targeted women's health providers and facilities. He has been keeping track of the recent story in articles on the Women's E-News and the Talk to Action websites. He joins us now by phone from Massachusetts. Welcome back to Counterspin, Fred Clarkson.
Thank you, Steve. Good to be with you.
Well, let's start with your Women's E-News piece, which could be read as a sort of guide informing readers as well as reporters about what to look for in anti-abortion violence stories. The title of that piece is Beware the Lone Nut Theory. What do you mean by that?
Well, very simply, when something really heinous happens, we often think that whoever it is who did it was crazy. And we also tend to think that they acted alone, because only a crazy person acting alone could do something so terrible. But with political crimes like this, particularly religiously motivated crimes, they're operating out of a social and ideological context. And in fact, in my tracking of the major anti-abortion crimes investigations I've done, people generally are neither nuts nor alone. And they carry these crimes. They're usually well-planned and very well thought through. The case of Dr. Tiller is a perfect example, because here the alleged shooter traveled all the way from Kansas City to Wichita and somehow knew exactly where to find Dr. Tiller at a certain time on Sunday and to shoot him in the head. Why is that significant? Well, it's because most abortion providers have to wear bulletproof vests, just because of the constant threat on their lives. And Dr. Tiller in particular was known for wearing a bulletproof vest. So in order to be sure that you killed him, you would have to shoot him in the head.
And what, in this story, as it emerges, do we know anything in this story besides those circumstances that he has a network of supporters?
Yes, the suspect, Scott Roeder, has been very involved in clinic protests over 10, 15, maybe even going back as far as 20 years. He's specifically, somebody posting under that name has made all kinds of comments on Operation Rescue websites, and the people who have been involved in clinic protests and even in clinic violence, at least in Kansas, know him and know him well and say they have.
One thing that's remarkable about this story and about the entire saga of anti-abortion violence is how unremarkable, how routine is the use of inflammatory language by mainstream anti-abortion figures. We know, for example, perhaps most dramatically from Rwanda, where hate radio was essential to stirring the genocidal madness, that hateful words can set the stage for or even fuel violence. Now, we know also there have been recent reports about how Fox's Bill O'Reilly, before Tiller's murder, referred to Tiller as a baby killer and compared him to Nazis. But O'Reilly isn't, to borrow a phrase, the lone nut here using inflammatory language, is he?
Well, no, indeed. In fact, there was a time when calling abortion providers mass murderers and Nazis and baby killers was considered a pretty fringe and extreme thing to do. But in fact, that language, and perhaps more importantly, the ideas behind it have become unexceptional in mainstream discourse.
Well, you tell a story in your Talk to Action piece about Rick Warren, the mainstream, widely considered, I think, an uncontroversial mega church pastor. Tell us that story, if you would.
Rick Warren, Southern Baptist mega church pastor, had been billed as the new moderate evangelical and was close to Barack Obama and other Democratic Party leaders, and was honored with hosting the first presidential forum of the campaign season last summer at his church in California. John McCain and Barack Obama were both there and graciously participated. The deal was that Warren was supposed to ask each candidate identical questions. And so he questioned Obama very closely on abortion. When he questioned John McCain on the same point, he asked him, he also added that evangelicals consider abortion to be a Holocaust. And McCain says, I'm pro-life. Then Rick Warren opened and closed the candidates' forum, calling on Americans not to demonize one another over political differences. This after he himself had simply called Barack Obama and all pro-choice citizens, in effect, calling them Nazis. This was not exceptional. The very next day, he gave a major interview to a reporter saying the same thing and called pro-choice supporters and politicians Holocaust deniers. This is identical to the idea that Randall Terry and other more farther out anti-abortion activists use all the time. And the thing is, okay, well, Randall Terry calls people mass murderers and or invokes the Holocaust. His is a call to vigilante violence. If, in fact, as Randall Terry has often said back in Operation Rescue days in the 80s, if abortion is murder, then act like it's murder. To really take those ideas seriously, if abortion is mass murder or a Holocaust, that's a moral call to action. Now, we know when Randall Terry does it, there's no question that he's trying to mobilize people. So when Rick Warren or Catholic bishops or prominent politicians are doing the same thing, saying abortion is a Holocaust, abortion is mass murder, that's a profound moral call to action. And yet, when Rick Warren said it on national television, there was hardly a ripple in the political or media environment.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's been reported that the FBI received reports that Tiller's alleged assassin had been tampering with the doors at a women's health facility just days before he's alleged to have murdered Tiller.
The day before.
Well, since blocking access to facilities that provide abortions is a federal offense, allegations are reported to the FBI. But the FBI failed to detain or even question the suspect. Is there something about the way we as a society, including the FBI, think about people like Tiller that allows this sort of inaction? Is there something about people involved in abortion that diminishes concern about them throughout the culture?
Well, there certainly is. And undoubtedly, there are many kinds of reasons, but there is a pattern of exceptionalism, and it cuts across our culture. So, for example, if there were a systematic murder of bankers or newspaper executives or federal judges or the bombing of banks and insurance agencies, we would think it was a national crisis. We would call it domestic terrorism. Same thing even with super gluing locks. Mm-hmm. If it was happening at banks or supermarkets, the local cops would have no problem arresting the guy and taking him into custody. But that just doesn't happen all too often with abortion clinics and abortion-related crimes.
We've been speaking with Fred Clarkson. You can read his piece, Beware the Lone Nut Theory, on the Women's E-News website, and his piece, Inflammatory Rhetoric as the Context of Assassination, on the Talk to Action website. Thanks again for joining us today on Counterspin, Fred Clarkson.
Thank you, Steve. Good to have been with you.
The nomination of a Supreme Court justice might launch a thoughtful journalistic inquiry into the candidate's public record and history, with that information undergirding a vigorous public debate, including people with a range of views on that record and its implications for the court. But we live in this country, and we've got the press corps we've got, and the nomination of prospective Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor has brought media coverage that demonstrates, above all, just how difficult it still is to even talk about race and gender discrimination, and how many reporters seem to feel name-calling is an adequate substitute for such a conversation. Adam Serwer has been following the Sotomayor nomination for Tapped, the group blog at the American Prospect. They're online at prospect.org. He joins us now by phone from Washington, D.C. Welcome back to Counterspin, Adam Serwer.
It's great to be here.
Well, the fact that Sotomayor is Barack Obama's pick meant that conservatives would oppose her. The fact that she is female and Latina, I suppose, determined the nature of that attack for them. But one of the early and really tone-setting pieces appeared not in the National Review or the Weekly Standard, but in the New Republic. I wonder if you could talk a little about that Jeffrey Rosen piece. What struck you about it?
Well, I think the problem with the Rosen piece was that it relied almost entirely on sort of anonymous sources from people Rosen said were Sotomayor's colleagues or clerks. And a second problem with it was that there were some unquantifiable claims. So one of the anonymous sources was quoted saying something like, she's not very smart. Well, I mean, that's the definition of a sort of unverifiable claim, because not only can you not judge the credibility of the source, but not very smart is an extremely subjective judgment. Beyond that, it really sort of fits into general stereotypes that we hear whenever there's sort of vague, ephemeral, unquantifiable objections to a person of color getting a position of prestige, or even women for that matter, that they're overbearing, they're not that smart. It sort of implies that they didn't get where they are because of merit, but rather because of some sort of preferential treatment. And I think for some of us, I mean, Dahlia Lithwick pointed out that Rosen had penned a piece for the New York Times about 10 years ago or so, 1995, fretting that Bill Clinton's emphasis on diversity was hurting the quality of liberal jurisprudence on the court. So it almost seemed like he was working from a predetermined conclusion about whether or not Sotomayor was going to be intellectually capable of serving on the court. But the problem with that was he didn't analyze her opinions, and he admitted doing that, which is sort of a problem when you're someone like Rosen, who really has the expertise to analyze analyze appeals court decisions, and you instead rely on sort of this anonymous gossip.
Yeah, he is the New Republic's legal affairs editor, Jeffrey Rosen, and yet that was kind of what was most striking to me. He starts off by saying he hasn't really read enough of her work to develop an opinion, yet he goes on to deliver this very loaded and what's turned out to be very influential piece. Well, you also had noted Jeffrey Rosen's earlier rhetorical question that he had in a column for Attorney General Eric Holder, which was, do you agree with Mr. Obama's implication that the Supreme Court needs someone who will side with the powerless rather than the powerful? What if the best nominee happens to be a white male? Well, that's the standard line about the diversity versus fairness. And it really seems to get at the core of this strain of argument. You've just indicated that women or people of color, unlike white men, have a bias toward their own. They can't be trusted to be impartial. That fear seemed to be behind the widespread, really widespread, misinterpretation of the wise Latina comment. I just wonder, are we missing something here, or is that argument just what it sounds like?
Well, I think two things are happening. I think there's a general problem with not recognizing that. So we all recognize that people of color and women have particular perspectives, but we generally fail to recognize that white men also have particular perspectives. Mm-hmm. And that sort of goes to the issue of journalistic objectivity, that objectivity is almost always really subject somewhat to the perceptions of the majority of reporters who happen to be white men. And I think, you know, in the recent case involving the strip searches on the Supreme Court, I think we saw a very sort of remarkable moment highlighted by Bob Summerby on the Daily Holler, where Justice Stephen Breyer said that he mentioned an anecdote, something about being, being stripped down in locker rooms and sort of other kids in school harassing each other in locker rooms, and it's sort of to say that this kind of nakedness wouldn't necessarily be humiliating. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a very particular perspective. He's coming at the issue from the perspective of a white man who, as a child, engaged in some sort of sophomoric mischief with his friends in a locker room, and therefore, to him, strip searching isn't necessarily humiliating. I mean, that's a very particular perspective. That's rarely recognized, either when it comes to judges or when it comes to reporters themselves.
Well, major media reporters, I guess, would say right-wingers are making these arguments, and some of them have been, we haven't listed them, but of course some of them have been very bold, folks like Pat Buchanan and Newt Gingrich and Rush Limbaugh calling her a racist and these things. They've said, well, major reporters might say right-wingers are making these arguments. We reporters, we're just noting them. We're just reporting them. I wonder, what is your response to that as an explanation?
Well, I mean, I think it is important that people, that reporters acknowledge what the right is saying, even if the perspective of unelected spokesmen for the party like Rush Limbaugh or Newt Gingrich are the ones who are getting all the air. I think the real issue is that with nominations to the Supreme Court, there's sort of a natural vacuum because these nominees are studiously avoid answering questions that are related to anything that might come up before the court.
Right.
So you sort of have to fill that vacuum either with biography or with analysis of their legal rulings. And I think that there has been some very good coverage of her jurisprudence, especially in places like the New York Times. But far and away, the best coverage of her actual work has come from SCOTUS blog with Tom Goldstein, who painstakingly went through all of her decisions and sort of gave a summary of each and really analyzed them over the course of her career. But I think there's an inherent problem with covering Supreme Court nominees that comes from the fact that they avoid answering difficult questions whenever they can.
And then the debate seems to also be truncated because you hear from conservative critics of this particular nominee. We've got a Democratic president. And then you hear White House support for her. But there seems to be kind of a missing piece of other people who are not in the administration who might have something to say about her qualities as a nominee.
Well, I think the most remarkable thing has been sort of the absence of Hispanic American voices on the issue. I mean, you have a whole Spanish language press that's been covering this, but in the English language press, especially particularly on cable television, you rarely see any actual Latinos talking about this issue. You see, you know, you can catch Pat Buchanan railing from his perspective about how he doesn't think Sotomayor likes white men, but you don't really see much of how Latinos themselves are reacting to the nomination.
Well, and you would certainly, it's not that Latinas are not being talked about. They're just
right.
Not being actually included in the story. Well, finally, whatever we may say about their performance, and the story's not over, of course, I think if Sotomayor is confirmed, as many folks think is likely, the media, by and large, may feel that, you know, they did their job. They generated some heat and some debate. They aired critics' views. But you can't help but wonder what the debate would have been like if we didn't have to spend time arguing that Latinas from the Bronx don't graduate top of their class and go to Princeton because they're stupid, you know, or if progressives were really part of the debate at the center of it, some people might even be suggesting that maybe Sotomayor is too corporate friendly or she's insufficiently progressive. I just wonder in our final minute here, what are some of the questions or issues that you'd like to see reporters explore as we go forward?
Well, once again, I mean, one of the problems is that some of the most important issues on which Sotomayor might rule, she doesn't have a long list of sort of legal jurisprudence on them, on issues of executive power or abortion. She doesn't really have a whole lot for people to go on. And that's really, that sort of speaks to that vacuum that's present when we're reporting on Supreme Court nominees. But in general, I mean, I'd like to see the press doing more of what Tom Goldstein did, which is looking at her rulings and looking at how she decides certain cases and focusing on that rather than focusing on her ethnicity or background, which admittedly, you know, the White House played it up for the reasons that they did. But I mean, that's the trap you get into.
We've been speaking with Adam Serwer of the American Prospect blog Tapped. You can find them online at prospect.org. Thanks so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the staff and interns at the National Media Watch Group FAIR, based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find them on FAIR's website, www.fair.org. The show is engineered by Kelly Spivey at Mercer Media. With me is Steve Rendell. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.